Katie Hebert, CEO of University Hospital and Clinics, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you, Jan.
I have a question before we start taping the podcast. I read that your father, Dr. Bernard DeMai, was really had a profound influence on you and your career in healthcare. Would you comment on that for us?
Sure. Well, my father was a third-generation physician. And he was a family practitioner in St. Martinville, Louisiana. He was one of those small town physicians. We lived a block from the hospital. Mm-hmm. And he did everything from fractures to delivering babies. So he was, it was those days when you know, when family practitioners really did everything in the community. And I saw the dedication every day that he had for his patients. Mm-hmm. And it was more of a vocation for him. It wasn't just a job. And I was always inspired by that. Mm-hmm. So I never really considered doing anything besides, you know, working in healthcare.
Right. Well, I know you've had a great career and really just hitting your stride with UHC. So yeah. Why don't we go ahead and start the podcast and you can talk more about that.
Okay.
Thank you. This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We record in the offices of Rader Solutions in the Light Center in Lafayette. Rader's team lets you focus on your business while they take care of the technology. If you're wondering if Rader can help your business with any and all technology needs, please visit RaderSolutions.com. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank for its support of this podcast. Founded in 1887, Iberia Bank is the largest bank based in Louisiana and is headquartered right here in Lafayette with 329 combined locations throughout the South. They offer the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Visit iberiabank.com for more information. We're also grateful for the support of Lafayette General Health. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit, community-owned regional health system, Lafayette General is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. Katie Hebert, CEO of University Hospital and Clinics, is our guest today. Her work with Lafayette General Health has included serving as the administrator of Lafayette General Surgical Hospital and later as the CEO of St. Martin Hospital. She has served as the CEO of UHC since 2016. A native of St. Martinville, Katie is a graduate of ULL and earned a Master's of Science degree from LSU. And Katie, I know you're dedicated to nurturing a culture of service within the health system. I want to thank you for joining us here today at Discover Lafayette so we can get to know you better and the work that you do at UHC.
Thank you, Jan.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. I always knew the hospital as UMC
mm-hmm.
and didn't really know much about it.
Right.
And I know in 2013, it was taken over, the operations, by Lafayette General Health
right.
System. So you've had your hands full since you were on board. Before we get into what you do today, would uh-huh. you give us a little background on where you grew up and what led you into healthcare?
Sure. Well, I grew up in St. Martinville, as you said earlier, and I'm one of 12 children.
What?
my father was a physician, and have been around healthcare, you know, just about all my life. I remember walking with him as a child to the hospital, you know, mm-hmm. and sitting in his office while he, you know, made rounds in the hospital and things like that. So it's just always been a part of my family, and just, you know, I really enjoyed growing up in a small community. I don't live there now. I live in Lafayette, uh-huh. but growing up in a small town just was it was a great experience as a child. Everyone knew everyone. You know, I just had to tell them my last name, and they knew.
Oh yeah,
everybody knew everyone. So
now 12 children.
No,
yeah. our guest recently, Popey Bio, was one of 17.
Yeah,
and I never expected you came from a family that size.
Right, I'm number nine.
Number nine. So they remembered your name when it was when somebody was in trouble. Did your mom call out everybody's name?
Oh yeah. You kind of go through the come on, hey, yeah. Katie. You know, I do the same thing. I only have three children.
Right. So you went to let's see. You studied at ULL?
I did.
Yeah. And did. Talk about that, please. Your
well, you know,
education.
I went to out of high school, of course, I went to college and finished in started at UL and then went to LSU E mm-hmm. to get I got an associate degree in respiratory therapy.
Okay.
I really wasn't interested in school at the time. I just my father said I couldn't get married until I finished college, so that was the quickest thing because I wanted to get married. And then I went to got married and had three children, and then decided to go back to school. And then
okay.
went back to UL
uh-huh.
and got my degree at UL. I think I was around 27 or. Yeah, about 27 when I got my degree from UL.
Raising then, little people.
Yeah, and then stayed out a little while and then went to LSU
uh-huh. yeah.
for my master's.
So in your early career, what were you doing? Did you go into administration or would you talk
no,
about
No, I started out when I finished at UL. Excuse me. When I finished at UL, I started out in cardiac rehab. Hmm. I'm sorry. When I finished at... Yeah, started on cardiac rehab. I was a coordinator for cardiac rehab patients and led them through exercise, their therapy, mm-hmm. post cardiac surgery, and then just as we do often in hospitals, you start off in a clinical area and then you just kind of gradually work your way up
into management,
yeah. and that's what I did.
Uh-huh. So yeah. You've always liked it, though. You never questioned going into healthcare, it sounds
like. No, I never yeah. have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about that in a little video before, that your father, Dr. Bernard DeMai, was really an influence on that. So
yeah, he was.
We were lucky. So then, let's see, you transitioned and ended up as administrator at Lafayette General Surgical Hospital. And then what led you to be CEO at St. Martin? Like, what... Was that the career path once you got into management that called
yeah,
out to you?
Yeah, when I started, when I was at, I actually spent 15 years of my initial career in New Iberia. Lived there for about 30 years and worked at Dotrieve Hospital. Mm-hmm. It was an HCA facility at the time. And really gradually worked my way up in management there. And then began working for Lafayette General. The first week, I knew was the place I needed to be.
That's great.
Nonprofit mm-hmm. Healthcare organization. Just the whole culture at Lafayette General was very impressive to me. And one day, I got a call from David Calicott and said, "Katie, I want you to go to Brobridge." I said, "Okay, I will."
Yeah, he's tough to say no to, I'm sure.
But I've always enjoyed, leading healthcare organizations, and I knew there was a great opportunity at St. Martin because it was the first hospital really took over. Lafayette General did.
Right. Was that in 2008? About
around 2008. Mm-hmm. That is correct. Mm-hmm. I started there. I think it was 2009, but it didn't matter. And I started in 2010 there. And they really wanted to do a lot of remodeling of the hospital and bringing new services to the community. And that was real exciting
yeah.
for us to be able to do that. So I was happy to be a part of that. We expanded the ER there mm-hmm. at that time and added on an outpatient section of the hospital. So that was fun.
Right.
And now they're... At St. Martin, Karen Weibel's there now as the CEO, and they're talking about another huge remodel mm-hmm. of the facility. So
you
it's
really
great.
Started there when things were starting to explode for Lafayette General.
Yes,
when it became a health system.
Right.
Right.
I started at Lafayette General the year before David uh-huh. Started, and he really had a vision. Has a vision too, of really growing.
Right.
And not only what. I think was so great about Lafayette General is we really don't want to compete with the rural communities. We want to partner with them.
Right.
And we want the health care to stay at the appropriate setting in the appropriate hospitals, mm-hmm. but we want to be there, you know, in the Lafayette setting for when they need more. So that's right. really that's really been our focus as we've expanded
right.
Lafayette General.
And I know you've got a strong board of directors behind
right.
this vision. We had
sure.
David on recently, and he talked about he came in with that directive, and they've
right.
really been supportive of you and everyone that's helped mm-hmm. grow that network. So,
yeah.
So Katie, let's talk about the services offered at UHC, mm-hmm. University Hospital and Clinics.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned earlier, that was traditionally known as UMC, and people knew that it was, you know, I guess you call it a charity type
right.
of hospital. Can you describe the facility today?
Sure. And, you know, just to give you a little bit of history, before we went on, you know, it was UMC, it all started on St. Mary Boulevard. It was, you can call it the charity hospital.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the mindset that a lot of people
right.
in the area had, that it was, you know, a charity hospital, because that's kind of how the state framed mm-hmm. the indigent care that they provided to Louisianians.
When was that there? Like, how far back are you talking about?
I'm talking about, I think it opened, don't quote me on the history, but I think it was around the 50s.
Okay.
40s and 50s. Stayed there till the late 70s. So we moved to Congress and Bertrand
okay.
In the early 80s,
okay.
80, 81.
Mm-hmm.
And they changed the name at that time to UMC.
Right.
And so today, we are, as you mentioned earlier, we are considered a public-private partner with the state mm-hmm. in running University Hospital and Clinics. We're a full-service hospital. The thing that makes us unique is that we're also an academic
right.
facility.
Right.
We have a family medicine residency program. We have about 28 family medicine residents that stay with us for 3 years.
Okay.
And then we have also have an internal medicine residency program. Again, about 26 to 28 mm-hmm. residents. In addition to that, we also partner with LSU, and many of the residents at LSU, we're the rotation site for. So orthopedic surgery, general surgery, GYN, mm-hmm. ophthalmology, the list goes on. Just about every specialty that you could think of, they do a rotation mm-hmm. and spend a three months with us.
Right.
ENT is another one. And so all of our services are provided by our faculty mm-hmm. as the supervising physicians along with the residents. So it's an educational environment.
Right.
And really, really, and many times doing cutting edge medicine at UHC.
So how does that work? So you're partnering with LSU. They're being taught, though, by your doctors?
Well, it's a combination.
Uh-huh.
The majority of the doctors are actually hired by LSU.
Okay.
Although we do hire some of the faculty, just mm-hmm. depending on the circumstance and situation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a combination. But we work very closely with LSU. Our associate dean for LSU is Dr. Jimmy Falterman.
Oh, yeah.
And he's from the area.
Right.
He lives in New Iberia, has a private practice in New Iberia.
Mm-hmm.
He sees patients one day a week, but he's there as the LSU lead, so to speak, for all the LSU programs at UHC.
So people that are coming in, they're really getting cutting edge treatment because students are learning the newest techniques, I'm sure.
That's right.
That's right.
And you know, the great thing about the area is that when you have a residency program, we know that residents usually, in many cases, remain in the area that they train.
Right.
And so it's really good for Acadiana to have these programs because, again, it's a great recruitment mm-hmm. to keep, you know, there's a shortage of physicians nationally. And so it really helps us to have the programs at UHC.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because I know I've heard that, you know, once you get settled, especially the 80, excuse me, the how many are full time there?
Well, we have on any given day we have probably about 82 residents
82,
on campus.
Right. Yeah.
82
I don't want
to 90.
Speak. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I mean they're putting down roots in 3 years. I mean you know.
Yeah.
And why is there a shortage of physicians? I mean what is your understanding?
Well, I think in many cases we don't have enough in the country enough residency programs. Mm-hmm. It's an arduous process for an entity to start a residency program, and it's expensive.
And it takes forever.
It's very expensive for any type of organization to start a residency program. Mm-hmm. So you have to be prepared for that. Mm-hmm. And there are just not enough of them out there. And it's very expensive for students, even in like students that are in medical school. There are situations where they may graduate and they don't get into a residency program because there are not enough in the country.
Oh my goodness! So they have to wait.
Yeah. Or decide they're going to do something else.
Does that happen? I mean,
it does
I guess
happen.
I'm getting off track, but to get a medical degree, my goodness.
Yeah, it does happen some.
Between the time and the student debt, which...
And, you know, that's another thing. I mean, when the majority of students finish and residents finish, they have so much debt. Mm-hmm. And so some people choose just not to even do it because they don't want to have that much debt when they finish.
Right. Gosh, that's just heartbreaking.
And, you know, our population is also, you know, the baby boomers mm-hmm. are getting older.
It's aging out.
Seeking more care, too. Mm-hmm. And that also adds to the shortage.
Right, right. So what type of doctors? I know that you said there's a few specialties, but I know there's really a need for internists, right? Just for the mm-hmm. the basic bread and butter, I guess, type of practice that most people would go to. So... So, Katie, with these residents that are populating mm-hmm. UHC, would you talk about some of the clinics that they work in and the people that you're helping with the residents?
Well, you know, in both residency programs, family medicine as well as internal medicine, mm-hmm. the residents need to be exposed to all specialties because mm-hmm. they need to learn about all of them. And so over the past, I guess, 2 or 3 years, we've really done a great job in recruiting young physicians in different specialties mm-hmm. to the hospital. We have a rheumatologist, we have a gastroenterologist, we have an endocrinologist, and so we have been able to open clinics where our residents can be supervised mm-hmm. by the faculty, and really expand access to care for our patients in the community.
Right.
We see, you know, on any given day, we see about 800 patients.
That's incredible.
At UHC in our clinics. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, just rough numbers. We have 10 clinic spaces, and within the clinic spaces, we have 22 specialties. So I think, you know, that number alone is pretty impressive. Right. So on our campus, you know, when you look at it, it looks like it's just a huge hospital. But within the hospital, we have those 10 clinic mm-hmm. spaces. And we're just about running out of space. We had so much we could do, but we're limited to the footprint.
Right. And, you know, you were mentioning your father being kind of a jack of all trades, Dr. DeMai.
Yeah.
With today's specialties, I mean, really it's almost impractical to think about a rheumatologist actually seeing somebody that wasn't in that needing that type of care. Is that right? They
become
so specialized, but they still have to rotate through just in case they have to help someone.
Right. And they need to have an understanding of the pathology and an mm-hmm. and understanding of the disease process of that specific specialty. Because, you know, internal medicine and family medicine physicians also, I mean, they're going to treat their patients and with all of those disease processes, mm-hmm. and it's only when they really need to see a specialist that they refer them.
Right, so they have to be able to diagnose
that's correct.
Yeah. Gosh. So, Katie, I understand that you have a new urgent care clinic that's larger than what you've been having, and it's mm-hmm. going to be opening this fall. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, we're really excited about it. 2 years next month, we really saw that there was an opportunity for us to, you know, and we're not unlike many hospitals all over the country. We're trying to, for we're trying to have an avenue for patients to not have to go to the emergency room unless it's a true emergency. Mm-hmm. It's the most expensive place to receive care. And we found that many of our patients, particularly our Medicaid patients, you know, if it's on the weekend or if it's after hours and they have an earache, well, that's it. That's urgent because your ear is really hurting, but it's not an emergency. And so we wanted to have a different avenue for them to seek care. Mm-hmm. And so because space was limited, we decided 2 years ago that we were going to open an after-hours clinic. Mm-hmm. So for the last, you know, for these past 2 years, from 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, we have an after-hours clinic, and then we open on Saturday and Sundays for 8 hours, 7 to 3. And we actually, it's actually in the space where we have our internal medicine clinic.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it has gone over so well that we decided that we would really, and when we opened the after-hours clinic, the intent was to always do something full-time. Mm-hmm. And so we're real excited to be opening again early fall, September-ish, an urgent clinic. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be open Monday through Friday for 12 hours a day, and then 8 hours on the weekends. And really want to give those our patients a more convenient way to take care of those urgent but not emergent.
Yeah, yeah. I read that you had said that.
Yeah,
it's a new phrase for me.
But we really want to get them out of the ER. Mm-hmm.
And I know that's big with reimbursements.
It is.
These days, I guess whether it's Medicaid or private insurance, the more they're in your emergency room, really the deeper the hospital goes in the hole.
And we are in active discussions with all of our health plans to say, hey, this is what we want to do. What do you think? And they're very excited about it because it helps everybody.
Right.
It helps the patient. It helps the managed care companies. It helps us because it's putting the patient in the right place at the right time.
And then you can counsel them. Your staff can counsel people when they're in the emergency room to say, you know, for other things, I'm sure y'all are doing that in educational process to let people know they don't
next
have to
time
go straight.
Next time, this would be an option. Right. That's right. That's right.
Can anybody go? Like, is this for private pay patients also?
Anybody can come to the urgent clinic.
Is that the same for UHC? Can't private pay patients come? Is that?
Yeah.
Do you see that?
You know, I think that's a misconception that many folks have in our community we're strictly for just patients that are on Medicaid or patients that don't have an ability to pay for their services. And although we do take care of those patients as well, we see many patients that have an ability to pay, that are on managed care plans, on Blue Cross and United and all of those. So we see a wide variety.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I've had a girlfriend that said that her doctor switched, I think she was in private practice and is now at UHC, and Patricia followed her to UHC because she knew that was the best, in her opinion, in that field.
Right.
And so that was the first time I really thought about private pay patients going to UHC.
Right. So. Well, you know, it's an image. And when I got there, one of the things we've talked about a lot is, you know, even our employees, because, you know, our employees, we have a I'm really proud of the staff that we have and our employees, the culture of service that we really nurture at UHC. But some of our employees, when they're new to us, say, this is the best kept secret. I said, we don't want it to be a secret.
No, we want people coming.
Get the word out, you know. And so we've tried really hard to change the image of the hospital, and I think I feel proud. I think we've done that in many cases, using the example of your friend, you know. She wouldn't have sought UHC in the past, but because we recruited a doctor that she had a lot of faith in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. She wasn't going to go anywhere but with that doctor. So I was looking at some information you provided, and I'm not quite sure how you talk about these statistics, but in an average year, you see about 54,000 unique patients. Is that right?
Yeah.
What does that mean, unique?
Like, yeah. So one person could come to the hospital four times.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're not counting them four times. That's a unique patient. So really... we say it that way because it's really it's really much more than people would think. So the 54,000 means
individuals.
Individuals.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Right. And I saw that also more than half actually come from outside of Lafayette. Is that still correct?
That's correct.
So they're coming from throughout Acadiana.
Acadiana.
Is this the only hospital of this nature? This is it in our region, right? That's a
major teaching facility?
Yeah. And I guess people with Medicaid can go anywhere, but.
Right. People, and now with Medicaid expansion that happened in 2016, people could always, with Medicaid, go anywhere. Mm-hmm. But more people in Louisiana now have the opportunity to be on Medicaid. And so it has really expanded the Medicaid population.
Right, right. I just had no idea about the huge number of people and visits that you have to shepherd. So Katie, I want to say congratulations on the good job you're doing. I saw for the second year in a row, UHC was selected as one of Modern Healthcare's 2019 best places to work in the healthcare industry.
Yes.
That means a lot for not only patient satisfaction, but employee satisfaction. Can you talk about your focus on service in the workplace?
You know, I tell our employees all the time that, particularly in healthcare, I think we're called to serve. And, I tell them we're called to serve our patients and care for them. We're called to serve our physicians. And we're called to serve each other. And so if you don't have that call to service in your heart, you're probably in the wrong place.
Yeah.
You know? And I make it a point to go to all of our employee orientations to kind of give that, set the tone, and talk about our culture. And I think it makes a difference because, I often say that people that are engaged in their work and happy to be at work do a better job than those that aren't.
It's just
a fact.
Yeah.
It's a fact,
right.
You know? And so we need, work can be fun. It doesn't always have to be,
a grind.
A grind.
Yeah.
And so, if we do the jobs that we're supposed to do and we're engaged with that work, it just nurtures that culture of service, and it also goes to the care that we provide. Mm-hmm. We're in a time where we serve everybody surveyed to death. You surveyed if you bring your car to be fixed. You surveyed if anything you do, they want you to do a survey. Healthcare is no different. Mm-hmm. And we're actually required to survey our employees by CMS. Our patients. But we want to know about the patient experience because, in healthcare, we always talk about quality improvement. We want to be better today. Mm-hmm. We want to be better tomorrow than we are today.
But if you don't know what people think, you can't fix
a
problem.
That's exactly right.
And people sure talk, don't they, if they have one bad experience anywhere.
That's right. They do.
Uh-huh.
And so... But I'm very proud of our it's called the HCAP score, our inpatient patient's perception of their care. We're in the top decile and have been most of the year, very proud of that. And it all goes hand in hand with, I believe, with employee engagement and being 100 best places to work. That recognition for 2 years in a row, you can't have that and not have good care, quality care, I think.
Do you find in your hiring experiences, people in healthcare, I just think they have to be both hearty in spirit and large of heart, because you're dealing with life and death and also some things that a lot of us just couldn't stomach. You've got to have a really special individual.
I agree.
That could, like you're saying, can not only have fun on the job, enjoy what they do, but also be caring and proficient in what they do. Do you find that when you interview?
Definitely.
Do you look for certain qualities?
Yeah, I mean, it again, it's the call to serve. And if you don't have that in your heart, you're not going to be happy in your job. And I tell that to people all the time. This might not be the place for you if that is not rooted in who you are.
Right. Do you have interns that come in, like students that shadow some of your professionals? Do you have that at UHC?
We do that a bit. Mm-hmm. We do that some.
Yeah.
We don't do the shadowing regularly, but periodically we'll have somebody in the community that wants to shadow.
Yeah. I remember in high school, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. I just really love the whole study of medicine. And so I was in the medical society, and we went mm-hmm. to Tulane's medical school, and I went for a minute in the gross anatomy lab. I mean, I had to run out. I got sick. And I thought, darn it, you know, yeah. I don't think medicine's going to be for me. But yeah. if you don't have those experiences, you don't really know.
Yeah.
Until you're on the job.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that's also a misconception, because many people in medicine will tell you that they fainted the first time they saw something.
Should I have gone back in?
You should have stuck to it.
I got so sick. I just thought, well, maybe something with the books, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gosh, are you still licensed in your field?
No, I have been out. I have been in administration for so long that mm-hmm. For over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm strictly a CEO.
Because I was going to ask you if you have any stories of any, like a success story that you'd care to share about somebody that you know the hospital has helped, and any kind of personal example of what makes your job meaningful to you.
Well, you know, there's so many. This is the kind of employees that we have, and you know, some of the patients that we care for have life struggles, socioeconomic yeah. struggles, and one particular day, and we actually celebrated, recognized the employees. We had a gentleman that was being discharged, and it was in the wintertime, and he shared with them that he didn't have any shoes.
Oh, God.
And so they were like, okay, what are we going to... They gave him the shoes they had on mm-hmm. and said, look, you can. Will they fit? You know, and they gave him their own shoes and just put on some little scrub shoes we have at the hospital and went home yeah. with that, you
yeah.
know. And that's the kind of people that those kind of stories happen all the time at my hospital. Many times, you know, there'll be patients or patients' families in the cafeteria, and they're looking how much, and you can tell mm-hmm. they're counting.
Yeah, with the tax and yeah. Everything.
How much I know how much I have in my pocket. Mm-hmm. Do I have enough to buy that? And we'll have an employee that sees them and says, "Sir, get whatever you want. We got it."
Yeah.
You know, and that's the kind of stories we heal people every day. Mm-hmm. You know, great stories of healing, you know, people with different disease processes. But what tugs at my heart the most is when we see a patient that's really in need in other ways.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
that we reach out.
I know there's the Beacon Connections mm-hmm. project that I do want to mention.
Very successful.
That. And I know that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Or sometimes social situation that someone's in keeps them from becoming well.
We call them social determinants of health.
Right.
That if you know, we've recognized on a national scale that if a patient falls in certain categories, mm-hmm. That they're going to have a harder time being healthy than other folks, depending on where they live. You know, if they can't pay their light bill, or mm-hmm. you know, we've discharged patients with prescriptions only to find them come back later, 2 weeks later, with this, they didn't feel their medicine
because they couldn't afford it. Right.
They were embarrassed to tell us.
Right.
So what we do now, we call it meds to bed. And so when the patient's getting discharged, the doctor writes the orders for their discharge meds, and we have a retail pharmacy at the hospital. So we fill their medications, give them their bag to go home, and it's then that if they... We can have those conversations. We said, we're going to fill up all your meds. Well, I can't afford it. And so we can find resources for them to mm-hmm. fill their meds and have those conversations with them.
Yeah.
And so we know we're sending them home with everything they need mm-hmm. so they're not back in 30 days.
Right.
You know.
Right. For anybody interested in that, please visit Beacon Connections. Mm-hmm. Holly Howitt
That's right.
locally was able to procure grants, I think from Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and others. And I've heard that Lafayette General has really seen the benefits. The whole system has seen the benefits of trying to help people that just don't have transportation. They don't have safe housing.
That's right.
They don't have shoes, as you said. You know, things that most of us just take for granted.
That's right.
So, yeah. We're here with Jason Sikora in Raider Solutions. And Jason, I know you've got some questions for Katie.
I've got some questions. I do. Katie, thank you for being here. And Jan, I think we might have stolen one of my questions. So I'm going to start there.
Okay.
What's the hardest part of your job?
Ooh.
And the most fulfilling part of your job? I think you answered the second part already, but what's the hardest part?
The hardest part.
You love your job.
Yeah. I think the hardest part is when I recognize that an employee, somebody that's part of the UHC family, is not the right fit.
Oh.
You know? Because... And that happens. That happens in business all the time, that you hire someone and just for whatever reason, it wasn't the right person, and having to have those difficult conversations, because everybody's a person and everybody has a life. And when you have to help them along into a different path, that's always hard for me, because I think everybody's important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's a great answer. I could see that being... I had to do that once in my life, and let somebody go. I was a manager, and it's so difficult.
Yeah, whenever I counsel my managers, you know, when they're having to do that, you know, and I tell them, if it ever gets easy, you're in the wrong business.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
It should be difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If your heart's in the right place.
Makes sense. What's a day in the life of a hospital CEO? Like, what are you going to do next? Are you going to lunch? Are you going into meetings research? Or
So at 3:30, I have another meeting to talk about something we're doing in the pharmacy.
Okay.
And so I'm a very collaborative leader. I like to have everybody at the table. I want everybody's ideas, because I think everybody comes to the table with a different perspective. So I have a lot of meetings.
A lot of meetings, a lot of decisions.
Yeah. And so I usually start my day. I usually get to work between 7:30 and 8. Okay. Start by going through my emails. And then I usually have meetings just about every hour of the day.
Wow.
Just
gosh.
About.
That makes sense. I mean, you got to run it, right?
Yeah.
And then finally... we've talked about this in some previous podcasts, but what changes are happening in the medical field that are going to change the patient experience and also the doctor experience?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, the telemedicine is the thing.
Yeah,
you
that's what I figured.
And, you know, at Lafayette General, we have really done a lot of work in telemedicine. And, you know, we started with the app on the phone where you could, you know, you could see a physician. For those urgent clinic person that would go to an urgent clinic can now do it over the phone. And I really think, I'm hoping that in the very near future, when we have our urgent clinic, we're going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. We're going to be able to have telemedicine visits. And especially for the you know, we talk about patients that struggle to even get, you know, I don't have a ride to go to go to my visit. Mm-hmm. Well, most everybody has a phone.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that's the biggest thing. And, you know, the electronic record, a lot of people complain about it, you know, because it's really changed. It's changed the throughput of the patient and how we memorialize records and everything. And physicians complain a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. Nurses have complained because it's a change. And it's a little more, it has had a little bit of an impact on productivity a bit, because they got a little, but, you're able to retain so much in that record that if I go from one hospital to the other hospital or to the other hospital, I don't have to worry about them having all of my record, because it's all going to be in that EHR record. It's all going to be in that record. We're going to have that exchange of information. So I think in the next several years, you're going to really see between those two, you know, with telemedicine and with the electronic record, I think that's going to be the biggest impact.
Yeah. I like having that transparency. I can see all my lab results right on my phone.
Right.
That's fantastic.
And also, if you're in another parish, let's say you're traveling and something happens.
Yep.
the whole network has access to your records, right? Whether it's UHC, St. Martin Hospital, or whatever, they have access.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing where technology goes and wearables and all those things are going to integrate.
Yeah, you know, as far as like medical, technology, we have robots now, that go into surgery that help that the doctors, I can't speak to all of the medical technology, but there's going to be a lot of things coming out in the next 5 years.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being here, Katie.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. And Jan, thank you for letting me
ask
some questions.
Thank you, Jason. Katie Abear, you're a great guest. And I feel like we're just kind of scratching the surface of what you do now that, the interview is coming to a close. Did I ask you everything that you thought we would cover? Is there anything that, we haven't talked about that you'd like to share?
I don't think so. We covered a lot of territory.
Good. Yeah, yeah. I think between telemedicine and the Beacon Connections Project, I think that we're going to see a lot of big changes for people lower income.
The big thing in medicine right now, in healthcare right now, is taking care of the patient outside the four walls of the hospital. Mm-hmm. So if we can provide services to keep people healthy, and that we talk in healthcare a lot about the patient being vertical or horizontal.
I know.
And it's the vertical that we want to keep them in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we want to stay vertical, too.
That's right. That's right.
On our end. Katie Abear, CEO of University Hospital and Clinics, thank you for being a guest on Discover Lafayette. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning into the show. You can access this show and all of our shows also at discoverlafayette.net. This is Jan Swift. Thank you for listening.